Thanks for coming to today's special colloquium. Our speaker is Maya Fischbach. She's a NASA Einstein Fellow as well as a Sierra Northwestern Fellow at Northwestern. Maya got her PhD at the University of Chicago in 2020. And she's been a member of the LSE collaboration for a number of years, and she's produced a number of influential papers within the small group of authors and as part of the LIGO collaboration itself, which includes her being the writing team chair of one paper and in the writing team member in three of the some of the many interesting papers the collaboration has put out. And today's talk, she will review some of those results and the reach of the physics that one can get out with them. So without further ado, Maya, please take it as whenever you can. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the introduction and thanks for the invitation to be here today. So I'll be talking about some of the astrophysical lessons that we've been learning from LIGO and Virgo's black holes. And the black holes that I'll be talking about today are in binary systems, such as this one. So you have this gravitationally bound system of two black holes that are orbiting around each other. And as you can see, as they orbit around each other, the orbit is actually shrinking. They're getting closer and closer together through the emission of energy and angular momentum in gravitational radiation. And eventually, they get so close together that they merge and form this bigger black hole. So that was just a simulation. We don't actually see these things merge with light. The way that we can tell that these two black holes have undergone this coalescence is through the gravitational radiation itself. So the gravitational waves are like these ripples on this fabric of space-time that propagate out from the source and travel for billions of years until they reach us here on Earth. And one way to visualize the effect of these gravitational waves is to imagine that I set up this ring of test masses, such as the one you see here on the screen, and now imagine a gravitational wave propagating in through the screen. And what the gravitational wave does is it'll cause this ring of test masses to stretch and squeeze. So the neighboring test masses are experiencing a relative change in distance, and that change in distance is the gravitational wave strain. And what this gravitational wave signal looks like from the coalescence of two black holes, for example, is shown here in this cartoon. You can think of the signal as being split into these three different components. There's this in-spiral part where the two black holes are relatively far away, and it's mostly the masses of the two black holes that's driving the frequency here of the gravitational wave. The gravitational wave frequency is twice the orbital frequency. Then they get closer and closer together, and the gravitational wave frequency increases as the orbital frequency increases, and then eventually they approach merger. There's a peak in the gravitational wave amplitude, and eventually there's this final black hole that rings down. So again, this is just a cartoon of what that gravitational wave signal looks like. There are many people in this room who are experts at actually predicting these gravitational wave signals. One way that you often see these represented is in the time frequency representation, right? So I said that the frequency of the gravitational wave and the amplitude increases with time. You can see that here, where the color in each time frequency bin is proportional to the gravitational wave power. And something that starts off at low frequency and kind of quiet and then increases to higher frequency and higher volume sounds like a chirp. So often these signals from the mergers of two black holes or neutron stars are called gravitational wave chirps. We now have this amazing network of gravitational wave observatories that's actually able to detect these chirps from across the universe. There are the two LIGO detectors in the US, the Virgo detector in Italy, Kagra detector in Japan, and later this decade, LIGO India will also come online. And the way that these detectors work is by measuring these relative changes in distance. So like the ring of test masses that I showed before, where when a gravitational wave passes through the screen, you have this ring of this ring stretching and squeezing. When we have this interferometer, this gravitational wave detector, this L-shaped thing, when a gravitational wave passes overhead the detector, the two arms of the detector are going to feel this relative change in distance, and that's shown here. So we don't have a full ring of test masses, but we have these two mirrors which act at these two points in the ring, and that's how they're able to detect these gravitational waves by measuring the relative distances changing between the two arms through interferometry. And so just to summarize some of this introductory material, we have this compact binary coalescence that's emitting loud gravitational waves that are stretching and squeezing matter and can be detected as these relative changes in distance or this gravitational wave strain by these detectors, these interferometers. So we now have dozens of these gravitational wave signals that have been detected by this network. The first detection you can see here in this panel, GW150914, was detected in 2015, this very loud gravitational wave chirp. Since then, there have been dozens of more of these detections. As you can see here, each one of these panels shows a different gravitational wave detection. And we're now up to around 90 of these compact binary coalescences, these mergers involving black holes and neutron stars that have been observed through the most recent observing run, which ended 2 years ago. Now, one of the main questions that my research program aims to address is how are these black holes and neutron stars that we're detecting in gravitational waves actually made? And we know that one way that our universe makes these compact objects, these black holes and these neutron stars, is as the end states of massive stellar evolution. That's what you can see here on this plot. Depending on the initial mass of the star that you start off with, between around 9 times the mass of the sun, all the way up to hundreds of times the mass of our sun, and then depending on the initial metallicity of that star, so the abundance of elements in that star that are heavier than hydrogen and helium, you'll either end up with a neutron star when that star finishes its evolution and dies for these relatively low masses or these relatively high metallicities, or at the heaviest stars and the lowest metallicities, you'll end up with a black hole at the end of the star's life. So either a black hole by fallback or a direct collapse black hole that refers to the type of supernova explosion that might make that black hole. But we know that these compact objects are made through massive stellar evolution. This diagram is still, you know, very uncertain. This is just kind of a simple illustration. But first of all, it's only for single star evolution, and there are actually a lot of uncertainties too in exactly what the different masses and metallicities are. So one reason why it's actually so exciting to study these black holes and neutron stars through gravitational waves is to learn more about how these neutron stars and black holes are actually made. In addition to that, we not only get to study how these individual neutron stars and black holes are made, we're only able to detect these compact objects in binary systems in gravitational waves. So we get to study how binary black holes are made. And there are two broad categories of formation channels that we typically consider. There's isolated formation and dynamical formation. Each of those has many, many different subcategories. But the basic idea is that in isolated formation, you start off with two stars that have lived their whole life in a binary system. They evolve. Eventually, usually the more massive one collapses first, explodes in a supernova maybe, forms this black hole, then the second star explodes in a supernova. Eventually, you end up with two black holes in this binary system that maybe merge within the age of the universe. There are many different uncertainties here and many different physical processes that can take place. The main challenge is, how do you end up with two black holes that are close enough together that they can actually merge through gravitational radiation within the age of the universe, but not start off with two stars up here that are too close together, because stars expand by factors of 100 or more during their life. So if you put two stars that are too close together here, the first star will actually expand so much that it swallows its companion before you end up with two black holes. The dynamical class of formation channels takes place in dense environments where you have many stars that give birth to many black holes that interact with each other dynamically. And this can happen in the center of the galaxy. It can happen in globular clusters within galaxies. And you end up with many black holes that are interacting with each other and eventually can capture each other in a binary system that, again, can merge within the age of the universe. So there are many different questions that we're trying to understand in figuring out what are the origins of these black holes that we're seeing in gravitational waves. So the first one of these questions is, what were their progenitors? For the rest of this talk, I'll assume that we're studying the compact object remnants of massive stars, although of course there are other ways that our universe might create black holes, such as primordial black holes formed in the very early universe, and that's also something that we're able to study with these gravitational waves. But assuming they're massive stars, a second thing we want to understand is, when did these massive stars live and where did they live? Did they live in some of the very first galaxies in the very early universe? Are progenitors of future binary black hole mergers formed within our own galaxy right now? Then we want to understand, how did these stars die? So did they explode in a supernova? Did they just direct collapse without any supernova material ejected? What was the physics that governed that explosion? What kind of spin or kick did that supernova leave the compact object with? Then we want to study, even if we can understand how these individual kind of neutron stars or black holes are made, we want to understand, how did these stellar remnants actually pair up into these merger partners? So kind of what I showed on the last slide, did they spend their whole life living together in a binary system? Did they find each other through dynamical encounters? And then finally, once we have a merger, we want to understand, how did that resulting merger actually affect its host galaxy? How did it affect their environment? So if you have two black holes that merge together, probably there's not much of an effect on the environment. But if the merger involves a neutron star, we know that that can power a type of explosion known as a kilonova. It can create gamma ray bursts. And in that collision, we can actually create some of the heaviest elements in the universe through the R process, nucleosynthesis, and that can have a big effect on future star formation, for example. So all of these pieces of the story are going to affect the observable properties of gravitational wave events, and my job is to go from these observable properties of gravitational wave events to try to reconstruct all of these uncertain pieces of the story. So from the gravitational wave signal, we can actually learn a few properties about the black holes and neutron stars. And I'm going to focus on black holes for this talk. And so black holes, it's really nice. They're very simple. There are only a few properties that can be encoded in the gravitational wave signal. The first one are the masses of the two black holes. So the first thing we can learn is just, how big was each of these black holes. We usually label the primary black hole, M1, as just the more massive one. Then there's the secondary black hole, M2. In addition to masses, we can learn about the spins of the black holes. So how fast are they rotating? But also, where are these spin axes pointing? So are they aligned with each other? Are they aligned with the orbital angular momentum? What are the misalignments? In addition to spins, by having a network of multiple detectors, we can learn a little bit about where this merger happened, so localize it on the sky. And we can measure the luminosity distance to that merger. And if we assume we know the background cosmology, if we know the luminosity distance, we also know the redshift, and we know when in the universe did this merger happen. And so for the first part of my talk, I will assume that we do know the background cosmology, so I will use luminosity distance, redshift, and look-back time interchangeably. And all of these pieces together, we can learn them from the gravitational wave signal, and they're going to tell us about how these black holes are made. And so that allows us to turn that catalog that I showed with all those panels, with all those different chirps of the gravitational wave signals, we can visualize the catalog by looking at the masses of the black holes involved. So here, each one of these arrows is showing a merger system where we have these two component black holes of masses around 20 and around 30 solar masses that merge and form a final black hole of around 50 solar masses. And what I usually do is study these systems as a population. So I'm not so concerned with what are the masses of that first system with the 20 and the 30 solar mass black holes making the 50 solar mass black hole, but rather what are the parameters that are in common to all of the events. So the first step in doing that is to introduce a population model that describes the distributions of things like the masses, the spins, and the redshifts across multiple events. So a first example, which is the first thing that we did within the LIGO-Virgo collaboration, is fit a power law to the black hole primary masses. So this is just a one-dimensional distribution. What is the merger rate density as a function of the black hole mass? If it looks something like this, then we know that at around 5 solar masses, we have many black holes in the universe. At around 40 solar masses, we have fewer black holes. And then above 50 solar masses, there are no black holes in the universe, if this is the true distribution. That's what we're trying to learn. So we might fit this model with and try to infer what is the minimum mass, the slope of the power law, and the maximum black hole mass. When we do that, we have to take into account measurement uncertainty. So the fact that we don't perfectly measure the masses of the black holes at, say, 5 or 10 solar masses, we usually have some quite considerable error bars on those. But we also have to take into account selection effects. And by far the biggest form of selection effects that affects gravitational wave astronomy is the sensitive volume as a function of the total mass of the binary system. So in this plot, I'm showing for different mass ratios, which are shown here in the different colors, what is the sensitive space-time volume as a function of the total mass of the binary. You can see that at 10 solar masses, we can see those signals only relatively nearby, so we're only probing a smaller volume of the universe. Whereas as we get up to total masses of over 100, we're probing a much larger volume of the universe because those gravitational wave signals are inherently louder, and so we can see them to farther away. So I'll come back to this plot very soon. So for the rest of the talk, I'll give some examples of some of the astrophysical lessons that we've learned so far. The first one I'll talk about is gaps in the mass distribution. And there are two gaps that we've been thinking about in the compact object mass distribution. There's this upper black hole mass gap, which I'll talk about today. There's the lower neutron star mass gap, which is a proposed mass gap between the maximum neutron star mass and the lightest black hole. I'm also very interested in this. Won't have time to talk about it today, but feel free to ask me about it later. Okay, so going back to the black hole mass gap, and this is the plot that I just showed and told you I'd get back to. So right, this plot is showing the sensitive volume as a function of the total mass of the system. Oh, yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I think I would know what, if you said volume on the Earth, but you have a V and a T. What's the time?
Yes, so this is the observing time. So.
Oh,
yeah, so just the longer we observe, the more mergers we're able to catch. Yeah.
So what on yourself? Is that a slope of 2.2 easy to understand?
Sort of. Yeah, so if the universe was Euclidean and there were no redshifting effects, and so if distance was just Euclidean distance and volume was distance cubed, and there was no redshifts, then the amplitude of the gravitational wave goes like mass to the 5/6. And so the over distance. And so if volume is distance cubed and you have 5/6 cubed, you get 5/2, which is 2.5. And the deviation of this of 2.2 from 2.5 just has to do with the fact that luminosity distance is not, that the universe is not Euclidean, so co-moving distance is a little bit smaller than luminosity distance cubed, and that we have redshifting effects. okay, so in this, so I use this plot to argue that the biggest black hole systems are louder in gravitational waves. This means that in our catalog, the most massive black hole systems are always overrepresented compared to their true representation in the underlying universe. Despite this, in the first two observing runs, we had a couple of binary black hole detections down here with total masses of around 20. We had quite a few with total masses of around 60 to 70, so component masses between 30 and 40-ish solar masses. And yet we had no detections where the total mass was above 80 solar masses or component black hole masses were above 40 solar masses, despite the fact that our sensitivity continues to increase out to these higher masses. And so from that, I was able to conclude that the only reason this makes sense is if these systems are rare in the underlying population. So there must be an astrophysical dearth of systems where the black holes have masses above 40 solar masses or total masses of 80 solar masses. And so what I actually did to quantify this is to fit the black hole mass distribution to this power law form that I introduced earlier. So here we're fitting for a power law mass distribution with a minimum mass, a slope, and a maximum mass that we're inferring from the data. And each one of these lines that you see overplotted here is a possible mass distribution drawn from our posterior over those population parameters. And what you can see is that all of these possible mass distributions have a maximum mass of around 40 solar masses. So we're inferring with quite high. So there are 500 of these posterior draws overplotted here, and the vast majority of them cut off at 40 solar masses. There is some tail, like maybe the maximum mass is as high as 50, maybe a few in 500 chance it's as high as 60. But we really were confidently finding this maximum mass at 40 solar masses. And this was really exciting because not only was it kind of, the first feature that we were able to find from the gravitational wave data, we had 10 binary black holes. We found, hey, there seems to be a cutoff in the mass distribution at 40 solar masses. It was also very exciting theoretically because there has been this long-standing prediction for something called apparent stability supernova, which would create apparent stability mass gap. And this theoretical prediction has existed since the 1960s, where people were evolving these very massive stars, and they were finding that if you have your carbon-oxygen core of the star between around 40 and 120 solar masses, that core of the star gets very hot, and you have the photons that normally supply pressure to counteract gravity and keep the star stable, those photons in these massive cores start spontaneously producing electron-positron pairs. And so you have this pair production that is taking away that pressure support from your star because those photons normally act against gravity, but now those photons are turning into E plus E minus pairs that completely leave the star. And what that does is that you then have a sudden contraction, which is so energetic that you start to explosively ignite oxygen. And when oxygen explosively ignites, it can lead the entire star to self-destruct so the entire core of the star can collapse and not leave behind any black hole. Or it can lead the star to shed off mass in these pulses, so pulsational apparent stability. And each pulse can shed tens of solar masses of material from the star until the star safely collapses to something below the 40 solar mass limit. And so this prediction that there should be no black holes between around 40 and 120 solar masses where this apparent stability is predicted to end, this applies to any black holes that are formed from stellar collapse. While this theory has kind of been around for decades and the basic idea is not really being challenged by anyone, there are still some uncertainties in that location of the gap due to things like nuclear reaction rates that are going to control how much oxygen is in that core of the star, and so exactly what mass range you need for this apparent stability to completely destroy the star, things like stellar structure, and also possible beyond standard model physics. So if you have beyond standard model particles in the core of these stars, that this can also affect the lower and upper edge of the mass gap. And so actually studying these black holes in this mass range is actually also a novel probe for some of these new particles. Of course, one really important thing to mention is that this applies to black holes that are formed from stars. If you have black holes that are formed not directly from stars, they would easily be in the gap. So one kind of trivial example of this is if you have black holes formed from smaller black holes. We saw in the very first LIGO detection, two 30 solar mass black holes merging into a 60 solar mass black hole. That black hole at 60 solar mass is in the mass gap. The question is whether those black holes formed from previous mergers can go on to participate in another merger and merge again. And this is also something that I've been very interested in for a while. One interesting thing about this scenario where you have two black holes that form a bigger black hole is that those black holes, in addition to being more massive, will also have a distinct spin. And if you look at the spin distribution of black holes that are formed in these repeated mergers, they'll tend to all be spinning at around 0.7 in terms of this dimensionless spin parameter that's between 0 and 1. These different lines here just show kind of different realizations of the mass ratios involved in the merger. But this is something that we're also looking for. I won't talk about this much further, but you know, we're looking for this distinct spin and mass distribution to test whether the black holes that we're seeing participate in mergers have themselves undergone previous mergers. Okay, so going back to the mass gap, everything I've told you so far about there being the sharp feature at 40 solar masses, that was just based on the first 10 events. We now have dozens of these events, and we've had some surprises in the most recent observing run. So one of the most unexpected and exciting events was this binary black hole merger called GW190521 that happened back in 2019. In this merger, we had two black holes of around 85 solar masses and around 60 solar masses. So they seem to be right in this parent stability mass gap. And when this came out, when we announced this to the world, there was a lot of excitement because here we have these black holes shouldn't exist. They fell into this forbidden range of masses. So again, this forbidden range of masses is something that had been theoretically predicted, but also within our own data, we were finding a feature at 40 solar masses, this drop off. And in addition to that event, my job for this third observing run was to try to make statements about the full population of black holes. In addition to that one event that had those two really massive black holes, we actually had a handful of events that also had black holes above 40 solar masses, above where we were finding that maximum mass cutoff from the first two observing runs. So in addition to 190521, you can see the primary mass of that event plotted here. At around 85 solar masses. We had these are just showing two other examples of posteriors on the primary masses of other events that were definitely above 50 solar masses. Compare that to our inference on the maximum mass from those first 10 events at around 40 solar masses. We're now having all of these black holes that we're observing that are incompatible with that maximum mass. So the first thing we can say just looking at that data is that our power law model with a sharp cutoff is now a bad model for that data, because we inferred a sharp cutoff to be at 40 solar masses. Now the only way that these new events can be compatible with that is if that sharp cutoff was shifted up to 80 solar masses. That can't be. That model is just bad. But we can also learn a lot about the underlying physics that's producing this mass distribution. So what we can really say is that there's still some feature at 40 solar masses, but the rate of black holes above 40 solar masses is non-zero. So maybe a power law model is a bad fit to the data, but you know, maybe we can do a broken power law where there's a break in the mass distribution at around 40, after which we have a steeper power law. So there's still a relative dearth of these bigger black holes above 40 compared to those between 30 and 40. Similar thing here, maybe the mass distribution is described by a power law that has a Gaussian peak on top of it. And so maybe there's actually a buildup of black holes between around 30 and 40 solar masses, after which we have a steeper drop off here in the mass distribution. But it's a really interesting question to try to understand, where did these big black holes above 40 solar mass come from? So are these black holes inside the mass gap because maybe they're made in a different formation channel that contaminates the gap? Like maybe these are hierarchical merger products that are merging again. And so we're also looking at the spin distribution of those to try to figure that out. It's also possible that this lower edge of the mass gap is just starts here and it doesn't fall off infinitely sharply, but maybe it just tapers off because we have some more complicated stellar structure, like some of these stars are holding onto their hydrogen envelope, and that's contributing additional mass to the core. Maybe the structure of the stars is more complicated because some of those stars have themselves gone through stellar mergers before. If you have stars in a young star cluster, for example, maybe there's some accretion going on to the final black holes. Maybe stellar evolution produces a sharp cutoff at 40, but then these black holes are in environments where they can accrete additional mass. It could also be that the mass gap is just starting at higher core masses than we thought previously. So maybe, you know, this feature we're seeing at around 40 solar masses has nothing to do with parent stability. There's actually a mass gap that only starts after 80 solar masses. And that would tell us something really interesting about the nuclear reaction rates that are taking place in these cores of massive stars, or perhaps new physics that is taking place in these stellar cores. So there's still a lot to disentangle. We only have a few events above 40 solar masses so far, but there's a lot to look forward to with more data to try to understand all these different physics that could be contributing to this more complicated mass distribution.
Can you expand? I mean, on the previous conference, you even talked about beyond the standard model particles. What kinds of things are people speculating about there?
Yeah, so people have been thinking about axions in a specific mass range and with specific coupling to electrons or photons in the stellar core that could essentially, the first idea, so the first idea that I know of was proposed a couple years ago by Juna Kroon, Jeremy Saxteen, and Sam McDermott. And they were saying if you have axions, electrophilic axions in the cores of these stars, that could provide an additional cooling source, an additional kind of source to suck up that additional energy, which would then just change the equation of state of the core, which would mean that parent stability would take place at a different mass range. Lots of ideas here. I think it's also important to kind of compare, you know, what we're able to test in massive stars as opposed to other other physical systems where this may happen. Yeah.
Maya, do you have a preference for a specific explanation for some of these heavy black holes, like, or are you completely agnostic? Because you mentioned all the, you know, these alternative proposals that are on the table, but is there something that most likely for some of the specific events you've seen?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, selfishly, I guess I thrive off of the confusion because then there's more work for me to do. But I think that right now I'm tending to think more the hierarchical mergers scenario. We don't see any clear evidence for that, and it would kind of have to be in that we don't see like that clear correlation between masses and spins. That would be a signature of that. But we don't see anything to really rule it out. It would have to be in kind of environments with very high escape speeds for that scenario to be possible. So not typical globular clusters where the escape speeds are like 10 kilometers per second, because at the rate that we see these bigger black holes, it's still only 1% of the underlying distribution, but the typical kicks that black hole merger products receive are above 10 kilometers per second. So you still, there's not really like a, I think even a clear environment where we can point to, but I think it probably still happens sometimes. And then I think hierarchical mergers probably do take place sometimes. I actually don't think that it's enough to explain the rate that we see. So it's probably some combination of other things too. I definitely bet that it's more than one thing. okay, yeah, so that was all I wanted to say about mass distributions for now. But if anyone else has questions, I'm also happy to take them. Okay, or I can ask at the end. But the next thing I wanted,
Yeah, I'm online, sorry. So like I remember like when this mass gap like events like first come up, like there are also like other choices of mass combinations which fits the data. What is the status of that?
Yeah. That's a great question. So I think that was specifically for that first event, GW190521, where kind of like the best solution from the LIGO-Virgo analysis seemed to be 85 solar masses plus 60 solar masses. I actually wrote a paper arguing that the data was compatible with 40 solar masses plus 120 solar masses, because the best thing we actually measure, especially for those very high mass events, is the total mass. We don't measure the mass ratio very well. So I still think that event is probably consistent with being something that actually straddles the gap, which would be really interesting. The reason that I don't think that explanation is really likely right now is because we've seen those other black holes with masses above 40 solar masses. So we've seen other examples, other events where those component black hole masses seem to be around 50, 60 solar masses. So it's no longer that we just have that one event that's really clearly an outlier from the data. We are now kind of building up that full mass distribution between around 40 and 80-ish solar masses. So I think and one thing that's nice about doing the population analysis is that we don't have to worry about things like prior choices, because we're finding the best prior for all the data. So we're able to kind of self-consistently stack that information across multiple events, which are telling us there's a population of black holes above 40 solar masses. Yeah. Okay, so the next thing that I'll talk about is some things that we can learn from looking at the evolution of the black hole population with cosmic time. And I'll just give a very simple example of this. And so one thing that's also getting really exciting as we're accumulating more events, our detectors are becoming more sensitive, and we're actually able to peer those events out to higher redshifts. And so currently in the most recent observing run, we were probing the binary black hole population out to around a redshift of 1 or around 8 billion years ago in look back time. And in blue here, I'm showing the inferred merger rate as a function of redshift on the top axis or look back time on the bottom axis, normalized to the merger rate today. And so you can see that we're inferring with some fairly large uncertainties still, you know, 8 billion years ago, the rate of black hole mergers was higher than it is today, just looking at the blue here. It's interesting to compare this merger rate to other things that we know that are happening in the universe, for example, the star formation rate. So we know that at very early times, at very high redshifts, the universe didn't form any stars. At some point, it started forming stars. Then the star formation rate peaked at around redshift of 2, around 10 billion years ago. And since then, the universe has been making fewer and fewer stars. Now, if those stars are the progenitors of the binary black hole mergers that we're seeing, there's some time delay between when those stars formed and then when those black holes formed, and then most of the time is actually spent getting those black holes to merge. And if you assume different time delay distributions, you'll get these different predictions for what the merger rate will be. So if time delay distributions are short, your merger rate will peak close to the star formation rate. If time delays are very, very long, then the peak of the merger rate will actually be pretty close by, and you'll have this flatter evolution of the merger rate as you look back in time. And so what we can already see just from this plot is that the longest time delays, so if we have most of the time delays greater than 3 billion years, this is already in tension with our inference of the merger rate, assuming the progenitors follow the star formation rate. And yeah.
You must have assumed something about the shape of the time delay distribution. Is this 1 over time or?
Yes, yeah.
Is there a reason to fix this for 1 over time or can you?
Yeah, there's.
An exponent as well?
Yeah. So in this paper that I wrote with Vicky Calogero, we actually did the joint fit for, you know, minimum delay time and slope of the delay time distribution. The reason that the default here is 1 over time is just in the kind of simple version of binary evolution. You have assuming a 1 over orbital separation distribution for the initial orbital separations, because the gravitational, the time it takes to merge through gravitational radiation goes like that power to the 4th. If you put everything together, you end up with a 1 over time distribution. But that really only applies in like the simplest version. If you have like mass transfer, common envelope, it can change that. So yeah, we should fit for more complicated time delay distributions. So we can already see, you know, just roughly like if all of the delay times are greater than 3 billion years, though, this is in tension with our inference. And it's really interesting to try to learn about the delay times that it takes these mergers to happen, because that encodes a lot of the physics by which these mergers occur in the first place. And so I'm not going to go into this in detail. You can see I've just taken a bunch of plots from the literature of different predictions that people make of the delay time distribution for different formation channels. So also don't really try to compare these by eye, because like the scales are different, and like some of them are log scale and some of them are not. But the basic message is that these different formation channels are predicting different things for the time delay distribution. Even within a given formation channel, like isolated binary evolution, this is a paper by Monica Gallegos Garcia, a grad student I'm working with at Northwestern, which shows that if you assume common envelope, for example, that's this set of curves that is peaking at lower time delays versus just stable mass transfer. So you get slightly higher time delays, right? You'll get these different delay times that it takes the merger to happen. Interesting here is in chemically homogeneous evolution, which is another kind of subclass of isolated binary evolution. This typically predicts much longer time delays. So in the simplest version of this, you get time delays that are longer than 4 billion years, which is already ruled out by our data if you assume that the progenitors follow the star formation rate. There's a lot we can already learn by just looking at the redshift evolution out to redshift 1 or so, which is where we're able to look right now. But this is going to get a lot more exciting as our gravitational wave detector network improves. So the next funded upgrade to the LIGO detectors, and Virgo has a similar upgrade too, is this A+, Advanced LIGO Plus, where you can see that will be around twice as sensitive as in the third observing run. So instead of being able to track this redshift evolution out to redshift 1, we'll be able to track the redshift evolution out to redshift 2 to 3. In the kind of further future, in the 2030s, there are plans for these next generation ground-based detectors that will go out to past redshift 10 and essentially see every binary black hole merger in the universe. So this is also going to be very exciting to look at just how the rate evolves with redshift, but also thinking about, are the masses of black holes different at high redshifts compared to low redshifts? Are the black holes spinning differently at different redshifts, which we're already starting to think about right now? Another thing that you can do to learn about some of these same questions is actually using other data sets in addition to gravitational waves. So looking at host galaxies, either if you find a host galaxy for your merger or if you have a catalog of potential host galaxies, you can look at things like the specific star formation rate versus the stellar mass of your galaxies. And these three panels are showing what the distribution of those galaxy properties will be for different time delays, starting from short time delays to very long time delays. You can see if the time delays are very short, most of your galaxies, that's what's shown in blue here, most of your galaxies will just be the ones that are forming a lot of stars right now. They'll be at the top of this panel. Whereas if the time delays are very long, most of your host galaxies will be the ones that are, just have the most mass right now. So they will have formed a lot of stars in their past, but are no longer so star forming today. So by finding these host galaxies, the cross here that's shown in here is the one host galaxy we have right now for the binary neutron star event. But when we actually have a population of these host galaxies, we can also learn about these time delays that way. Okay, the last thing that I'll talk about just in the last few minutes is some applications to cosmology. I guess I can pause here and see if there are any other questions from people on Zoom. Okay, so just some applications to cosmology. Okay, so this is where I stop using redshift and distance interchangeably and actually say that we don't really understand what is the background cosmology, what is the relationship between the luminosity distance, which is what we measure in gravitational waves, and the redshifts of these sources. And so gravitational wave signals from these compact binary coalescences are very unique because they provide us with a direct measurement of this luminosity distance. The gravitational wave strain is proportional to this thing called the redshifted chirp mass, which is a combination of the masses of the two black holes. That redshifted chirp mass we can read directly from the frequency evolution of the gravitational wave signal. So this redshifted chirp mass is what sets the intrinsic loudness of the gravitational wave source, and we can tell what that is just by looking at the frequencies of the gravitational waves. But the amplitude that we measure of the gravitational wave signal decays inversely with the luminosity distance. And so by measuring both frequencies and amplitude, we learn both the redshifted chirp mass as well as the actual luminosity distance to the source. And one goal you might have if you're a cosmologist is to measure the redshift distance relation. And you can do that with gravitational waves because these gravitational wave detections are giving you essentially a catalog of luminosity distances. If you had some other way of finding the redshifts to those sources, you can map out this redshift distance relation, which is going to tell you the slope of this redshift distance relation, h of z, depends on the constituents of the universe. So locally, this slope at this kind of linear relationship very close by is the Hubble constant. And you know, the evolution of this as you go out in redshift is going to depend on things like how much dark energy there is and what is the dark energy equation of state. And so we were able to do this for the first time to kind of make this Hubble diagram from gravitational waves with GW170817, which was the binary neutron star event where we had the host galaxy. We were able to infer the redshift from that host galaxy at around redshift 0.01 or a Hubble velocity of around 3,000 kilometers per second, and the distance from the gravitational waves at around 40 megaparsecs. The actual analysis that we did is a bit more complicated, but essentially, you know, fitting a line through these points, the slope of that line gives you the Hubble constant. In addition to that one event, there are other ways that you can get the redshift of your sources if you don't have an electromagnetic counterpart. And most of our gravitational wave sources don't have electromagnetic counterparts. Most binary black holes probably will never have electromagnetic counterparts, even if we were able to localize them really well. And so one way that you can do this for binary black holes that we pointed out is if you have some feature in the source frame mass distribution. Because let's say you know that you have some drop off in the mass distribution at 40 solar masses because of pair instability supernovae start above here. The actual universe is going to give you some redshift distance relation. And what you actually measure in your detectors is these redshifted masses versus luminosity distance. And so that feature that you have in the source frame at 40 solar masses, as far as detector frame masses, it's going to be 40 solar masses times 1 plus redshift. And so it's going to look something like this black line here. And so in reality, we don't know that there's a feature at 40 solar masses. We don't know what the shape of this mass distribution is, but we can simultaneously fit for the shape of this mass distribution and the redshift distance relation from this measurement that we have, which is detector frame masses versus luminosity distance. And so just an example application of that kind of analysis that we did to the latest gravitational wave catalog, this is in terms of the Hubble constant, so just that local slope. You can see that the binary neutron star measurement shown here in black gave us this Hubble constant of around 70 plus 12 minus 8 kilometers per second per megaparsec. If we use the binary black holes and simultaneously fit their mass distribution and their Hubble constant and combine that with this measurement you see in black, you get a slight improvement shown here in orange or in blue for these two different models for the underlying mass distribution. You should ignore this green dashed curve because that's using a truncated power law model for the underlying mass distribution, which I argued earlier is not a good model for the data. So we get some slight improvements when using the binary black hole events in terms of the Hubble constant. Of course, in the future, our binary black holes events, most of them will not be at redshift zero, they'll be at redshift 0.8 or above. And so this measurement will become a lot more interesting for inferring things like the dark energy equation of state, which is relevant at those higher redshifts around redshift one.
Oh, so can I ask you about this? I
mean, yeah.
And so the assumption, I guess, you know, you're making is that this mass distribution in its own rest frame is time invariant.
Yeah.
And so if you were to try to marginalize over any kind of time evolution in that, then is the error bar infinite?
It depends on what your model is for the time evolution. But yeah, that's a great point. So the simple analysis that I showed right now, if we were getting like Hubble constant error bars of 1%, you should not believe that. Like we have to, as we get more events, we have to make the analysis more sophisticated to account for things like the mass distribution might evolve with redshift. But I think we need, in that case, we're going to need to calibrate that to some external astrophysical knowledge. Like what features in the mass distribution do we expect to depend on metallicity? How much do we think they depend on metallicity? What can we say about the metallicity evolution of the universe and actually put some more sophisticated astrophysical modeling into that? I think the main thing is that it's going to be very difficult for the intrinsic evolution of the mass distribution with redshift to mimic the Hubble expansion. And so I'm optimistic that we will be able to disentangle those effects, but not doing the kind of simple inference we're doing right now. But, yeah.
Sorry, just to follow up on this, but do you think that a modeling of this sort would actually be able to get to like 1% or so? I mean, basically, you would need to understand the scatter in metallicity as a function of redshift, which typically
yeah.
Scatter, right?
Yeah. So I personally believe that this, like, essentially the method shown here, I don't think we're going to be able to understand the systematics involved to get. So the claim here from doing this analysis from, you know, this paper with Will Farr is that at redshift 0.8 with 5 years of observation of advanced LIGO at design sensitivity, we'll get to a few percent measurement of the Hubble expansion at redshift 0.8, which roughly translates to like 10 to 15% uncertainty on dark energy equation of state. My personal belief is that this is not going to be competitive, and like given the systematics involved with other probes of the Hubble expansion at those redshifts, it's nice because it's totally independent. But I think actually the main promise of this method is not measuring the background expansion. I think it's actually because any deviation from dark energy being a cosmological constant is going to affect the luminosity distance we measure with gravitational waves. If dark energy is not a cosmological constant, it's essentially some modification to gravity. And that's almost always going to couple to the gravitational waves and introduce some friction term that the gravitational waves feel. So I think that is actually probably the larger effect that we'll be able to detect first with gravitational waves, and also something that's unique to gravitational waves, because there are other things will affect like scalar perturbations, so they'll affect things that we can see like galaxy clustering, but it might affect tensor perturbations differently. Okay, so just one kind of quick other thing is that we've also been thinking about ways that we can do cosmology with standard sirens and kind of new ways of getting the redshift information in next generation detectors. So this is a paper led by my student, Christine Yi, showing that, again, this is kind of a toy illustration of that. But if we know the binary neutron star merger rate as a function of redshift, because we observe things like short GRBs and kilonovae and host galaxies, and we know that the binary neutron star merger rate peaks at redshift 2, for example, by measuring the gravitational wave distances of these neutron star mergers with third generation detectors out past redshift 2, we'll actually be able to see the peak of the merger rate that we'll measure in distant space for gravitational waves. So kind of you can see here that for a fixed redshift distribution, the distance distribution will be different for different values of the Hubble constant. And of course, this is an exaggerated range of Hubble constant values just to illustrate the effect. But if we measure some distance distribution shown here in this histogram, we can kind of infer, you know, which cosmology is the right one that'll match the peak and redshift to the peak and distance that we observe. Okay, so just to conclude, sorry I'm a little over time, but hopefully I've convinced you that there's a lot we can learn from gravitational wave populations. So the first thing we can learn is how are black holes and neutron stars made? So for example, where is the parent stability mass gap? Is there a mass gap between neutron stars and black holes? What are the natal spins of neutron stars and black holes? How do these neutron stars and black holes find their merger partners? All of that is encoded in the masses, spins, and mass ratios of the gravitational wave events. Then we can also learn where and when do these mergers happen. So how does the population evolve across cosmic time? How does that evolution tie into things like the star formation rate, the metallicity evolution of the universe, also the host galaxies of gravitational wave sources? And then finally, what are the cosmological implications of these gravitational wave sources? So in addition to the Hubble constant tension, which seems to be above 5 sigma right now, and so maybe standard sirens will be a really important part of figuring out what's going on there. There's also a lot standard sirens can do to probe dark energy, both through the background expansion and through this modified propagation that I talked a bit about in my answer. And then also looking at things like the clustering of these sources, the lensing of the gravitational waves. And so just looking ahead, I've talked almost exclusively about gravitational waves, but this is really a multi-messenger effort going forward. There's kind of a reason why multi-messenger has become this buzzword, because it is really what we need to be doing. And so in the future, you know, there's a lot that I plan to do to prepare for the future of gravitational wave detectors, looking towards discovering electromagnetic counterparts, host galaxies, and redshift. So I've recently been part of this Star X team, which is a proposed UV X-ray telescope that we submitted to the NASA MIDEX. One of the goals is to follow up these gravitational wave sources. And then also understanding how black holes in gravitational wave sources fit in with the broader population of stellar mass black holes. So recently, I've started thinking about comparing black holes in binary black holes to black holes in X-ray binary systems. And then finally, just putting these gravitational wave sources in the cosmological context of things like the Hubble expansion, structure growth, and cosmic chemistry. And with that, I will conclude.